One of the really delightful things we can do with a meditation is not come all the way out. So if you were enjoying that meditation, and I hope you were enjoying the silence, then we can really just support and allow that to continue in some way. So we don't end meditations necessarily. Just bring that same kindness of attention into the next activity. One of my favorite teachers who's been able to have some contact with recently, Gregory Kramer, has this lovely instruction for meditation to pause. And in that pausing, we just notice what we notice. And then to support that, we relax. That's really relax the body. And allow that noticing to have as much space, as much calmness as it needs. So, a real encouragement for this Dharma talk this evening to really relax. Be relaxed. Be comfortable. When we're comfortable, our listening is maybe just right. So, real encouragement to be comfortable. Comfortable for listening. Maybe we'll come to this point, but if that's really radically different than your meditation posture, then maybe your meditation posture might also need a little bit of adjustment. If it's not enough that you can relax in it. Is there anything we want to do to that? But we'll come back to a point like that. It could be an interesting insight. So my idea for this evening is to give a slow motion Dharma talk, spoken quite slowly. Now, if I start going too fast, I can't start throwing at you too many ideas. Just let me know. But also, it's also some of your responsibility to go slow with this as well. Slow and relaxed. Slow and relax. Pause and relax. So, in keeping with the idea of this retreat, this is going to touch on insights, and it's going to talk about how we apply those insights. You could say how we bring insights to life. Now, in English, that has kind of a poetic multiple meaning, like bring it to life. Bring it into our life, and also bring it to life, like putting a seed in the ground and putting water, we bring it to life, bring it back to life. Now, I don't know about you, but when I came to meditation, I really was imagining that I would learn something real or true about life, really kind of deep understanding about life. Like, what is this mystery? We seem to be born, we live a while, we die. What's this all about? What's the meaning of life? I was really curious about that. And, maybe that's going to happen for me one day. Maybe I'm going to get to understand the meaning of life. Maybe all of us will. Someone will crack it and we'll all get a sense of it. But it actually feels that Dharma teachings are offering something I would actually now value higher. Than being informed about the way things really are. And that is actually that they're not really any way at all. It's actually a much more profound thing to discover than that kind of final goal of now I understand, now I get it. So that's why we live and die. It's actually all of this is not any way in particular. It's not preordained. So everything that appears to this conscious being, everything that lands in attention, no matter what it is, they are fabricated, as Tsar expressed so beautifully last night. They depend on the way of looking. They depend on the way of relating. And this might seem like, that's really different Dharma teachings than I'm used to, but This is right there in the very opening line of the Dhammapada, you know, the very kind of pithy, short quotes of the Buddha. So just a heads up, if I say a word like pithy and you don't know it, then I'm going to say another word like, that I'm going to recognize, well, that's not a good word to use. So then I say short, and that means the same thing. So you don't, no one's getting lost here. So what it says in the Dhammapada is all appearances. Yeah, another word we can say is phenomena. Phenomena, it's Greek for appearances. Another way this is said is conditioned things. Yeah, so all appearances, all phenomena, all conditioned things. Right, that's to say anything at all you can bring your attention to. Yeah, all appearances are preceded by the heart and mind. Now, preceded, it means that the heart and the mind comes first, and then the appearances. Heart and the mind first, oh, and then an appearance. The condition of the heart and the mind shapes the appearance. Right? The appearance doesn't appear independent of the heart and mind. And so the Buddha had this wonderful idea at the heart of his path of practice, and in his teaching framework. So the way he practiced and the way he taught, they're the same thing. Everything is dependently originating. Right? Which is to say, it's arising this way due to countless causes and conditions. Okay? Countless causes and conditions, but we're really concerned about the quality of this heart and mind. Yeah? The conditions that this heart and mind is bringing into this. Okay. So that means that there isn't actually a way things are appearing. Right? It's not just one way that things are appearing. Now this might feel a bit complicated for this talk that's aimed at insights we can actually live and saying, well, you know, things aren't just any particular way. But we're actually talking about how something appears dependent on receiving attention and dependent on the flavor of attention. If something doesn't receive our attention, you know, like they say, you know, a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? It seems like a really kind of, well, of course it does. Don't need someone there to hear it to make a sound. But actually, does it make a sound? If no one hears the sound, is there a sound of a tree falling? Let's use a more clear example from today, perhaps. If a thought arises, but no one continues to think it, is there a thought there or not? Is that thought existing if someone's not there thinking it? Yeah. It needs that attention, needs that attention. More than that, though, it depends on the flavor of the attention. And when we talk about fabrication, that's really what we mean. All appearances have the heart preceding them. And the heart always has a way of looking, it has a way of listening, it has a way of relating. And that shapes that appearance. Yeah? All are shaped by the heart. And then, you know, the Buddha being the Buddha, there's just one more line that's really significant there. It then says, all appearances are made of heart. Made of mind, not made of anything else. This appearance isn't just affected by the mind, isn't just shaped by the mind, it's actually appearing in the mind, dependent on that perception, dependent on the mind to perceive it. And if you understand something about this dependent origination, you can also understand it's dependent on that conception of them being that way. Right, see how this relates back to our practice today, right? What we've been doing, paying attention to the body, looking for anything at all that's not unpleasant that we can rest the attention on. Yeah. So sometimes we talk about, you know, resting on the pleasant. More clearly, we're just resting on something that's not unpleasant. Even so, something that's okay. Yeah. Can we just rest the attention there? Now, what's happening here is actually quite a different conception of body than we're used to. It's not just anatomical physicality of the body. Yeah, when people say pay attention to the breath, they don't just mean, you know, pay attention to air molecules moving through and rippling in the sense here and there. We could actually see, and I think that maybe we were doing it today, actually the energy of the body as we breathe it. You know, it's kind of like ripple of the energy coming in and out of certain areas. I don't know if you've probably done this. Many meditation teachers will suggest it. If there's a painful sensation in the body, you can kind of imagine the breath radiating out through that area, yeah, and it kind of brings a sense of relief. Yeah? Has anyone tried that? I've done that. Breathe out through that area and kind of brings a sense of relief. How is that possible? You can't breathe out through your elbows or through your knees or through a bit of tension in your back. Except you can imagine that that's happening. Yeah, so to a certain degree, what the Buddha's saying here is if they're made of heart, yeah, the appearance is imagined in the heart. It's imagined in there and we can breathe out through it. When we conceive of the breath being able to do that, it doesn't also continue to exist as something in the physicality. Like that whole conception of breath this way can be available to us, and that, but that way of looking causes the appearance to appear that way in the heart, shaped by the heart, made of the heart. Yeah. So we're just beginning, kind of pulling on some threads here, and we're kind of going off into emptiness. And if I could see Zara's face, maybe she's even freaking out. This wasn't what you're supposed to be talking about. I don't know. Can't see her. And this could really kind of go off the rails. There's no way, no particular way anything is. There's no truth. There's just views. Just these different views causing appearances to appear different ways. This is a really liberating insight. But the Buddha was also really, really smart, and he just drew it back down to something very pragmatic, yeah? And so he comes back, and you know, these kind of four noble truths, yeah, kind of become the heart word of this understanding. Everything is dependently originating in these ways. But, yeah, but there is this kind of truth that we can anchor this to. And it's a truth in the sense of like it's a rule of behavior. It's like a principle, like a scientific law that we can observe and live in accordance with, right? So we have this dependent origination and then something wonderfully pragmatic that everybody experiences dukkha, stress, agitation, disharmony. Everyone experiences that. So he doesn't go into some kind of really abstract theory, yeah? Really something very direct. Everybody experiences dukkha. So it should be high on everyone's priorities to end dukkha. Yeah? And this is what I teach. I teach dukkha and the ending of dukkha. Yeah? I have a really great understanding of the market demand. You know, it's like everybody experiences dukkha. Surely everybody wants to end it. That's where I'm going to set up my shop and I'm going to, you know, become one of the most popular spiritual traditions in Israel in 2,600 years' time. Yeah. Well, okay, so I'm second to Judaism, but, you know, I know that the people who love it, they'll really love it. So, you know, we're not just immediately leading in with deep truths about the reality of this and that, just simple, pragmatic, but also very compassionate teaching. Yeah, relieving suffering. It's not something clever, it's something really, really good for the body, heart, mind, soul, attention, consciousness, everything, yeah. Untying that tangle of distress that leads to further distress. And this dukkha is arising due to causes and conditions. Yeah, that's what these noble truths are saying, yeah. So they're dependently arising from causes and conditions. Dukkha arises due to demanding for things to be otherwise. Yeah, this is what that Four Noble Truths are saying. We'll come back to this. But just to also point out that not only did he not kind of dive into kind of abstract things, he really started us off with the pragmatic, practical, easy to apply teachings of kindness, considerateness, generosity. Yeah. Like these are the preliminaries for practice. And they're based on a really profound insight. It's good for me. It's good for you. It's good for the whole world if I can be kind for the sake of this kindness. If I can be generous just for the sake of more generosity in the world. And see for yourself, what does kindness want to look like? You know, it might be setting a very clear boundary, it might be a protest, it might be calling out an injustice, it might not be so kind of soft and passive as we might immediately imagine. It's like, this is what the world is calling out for, this is what my practice is directed towards. And then it comes back to this question, is that what my practice looks like? So when you were speaking to yourself today, when your mind wandered, was that kindness? Was there generosity? Yeah. When you found yourself having a painful experience, were you able to bring compassion in that way? It's really obvious. We need to look and check in with this question. How's our preliminaries, you know, based on this deep insight? It's good for me, it's good for others, it's good for the world if I can express kindness to myself, to another, to any appearance in this heart and mind. So it can be really helpful for us to keep understanding that we take these insights and then we bring them back to our life. You know, just investigate. So, okay, so that's what this is about. How is it going? How is it appearing? Right? And as we evaluate that, lots of kindness. It's like, oh, I find out I wasn't very kind, so I think I'll beat myself up about that. You know, give myself a hard time. It's like, oh, you know, kindness to kindness. Keep going with it. Keep going with it. So there's a way of practicing the Dharma which has a very complicated word, which is phenomenological, phenomeno, like the phenomena, and logical, the logos, the idea of looking at phenomena, which is to say, what is here? What do I know? What do I experience? Yeah. We might say, what does mindfulness reveal? What does mindfulness reveal in my experience? And we're looking for the dependent origination of things. We're looking at the fabrication, this appearance. What do I know about this? Yeah? And what we'll know is that in life there is stress and that it must have a cause. Right? We know this stress, we know this distress, we know this discomfort. It must have a cause because it can be amplified and it can fade away. It will amplify, it will fade away at times. Which is to say, there is also relief. Yeah. There is peace. And there is dukkha. And that is to say, you know, a little bit more peace is always possible. So, right now, you might feel really peaceful, you might feel really agitated. Which, whatever it is, relax your shoulders for a moment, yeah? Soften your gaze. Maybe rest your attention somewhere that isn't unpleasant. Like the palms of the hands, maybe the breath, the roof of the mouth, yeah, inside the mouth at the top, the tongue itself, yeah, anything like this. Just rest it there, just rest it there. Just a little bit more peace is always possible. So the really core question, which we already touched on a little bit, is like, what does peace or dukkha depend on? And so the answer to that is this key insight of Buddhism, this noble truth, yeah, which is dependent on this principle, dependently originating experiences, yeah, preceded by the quality of the heart-mind, the mood in the heart-mind. Yeah? And a specific rule, which is the specifics of this cause and effect, yeah? Demanding for life to be otherwise. Or we could say, demanding for life to be according to my preference. Yeah, this is that push and pull on life. I like this. I want more of it. This kind of pull naturally seems to come, yeah? Oh, that sound. Oh, I don't like it. Immediately, it's kind of pushing away. It's pushing and pulling. It's quite deeply embedded movement of the being. Yeah. And this push and pull in the Buddha's language, so dukkha is from the Buddha's language, and tanha, thirst. Yeah, push and pull on life, this kind of thirsting at life is causing that. And that's what is co-arising with the dukkha experience, this relationship of cause and effect. And that key, that's what unlocks the dukkha, opens the doorway, opens this doorway as wide as an ocean to freedom, this understanding. So, okay, so that's how to get rid of dukkha. But how do we get rid of demanding? So how is demanding dependently originating? So you see, we have this paradigm key to compassionate practice, this lessening of dukkha. So where is the dukkha right now? How can I release it? Here and now, also there and later. We're lessening this demand, but demanding is depending on things, it's depending on preference. But I want my preferences, yeah? I want my preferences to be met. But is that worth dukkha? If that's the choice? Getting what you want, getting what you prefer, having life the way you want it, is that worth the dukkha? It seems to be kind of in this point. But we can also unpack this a little bit more. What are my preferences depending on? These so-called my preferences. Are they mine? Did I make them? They belong to me? Or are they also dependently arising? Appearances in this heart and mind, yeah? Dependent on other causes and conditions. And so a way of explaining this preference idea touches onto a really deep teaching called the Vedana teaching. And so the Vedana is a type of categorization of experiences. Right? It might sound complicated, but it's kind of saying this sensation is going to be, this sensation you can feel now of whatever it is, touching your chair. Yeah. That sensation, it's either pleasant, it's either unpleasant, or it's either neither pleasant nor not pleasant. Right? Not really pleasant, not really unpleasant. The not bothered Vedana. Yeah. So it's either nice, oh, it's nice and I want it, I enjoy it. It's not nice and I don't want it, I don't enjoy it. Or it's not particularly nice, not particularly not nice. Not too bothered about it. Now, this preference depends on that categorization, but it also depends on taking the categorization and the preferences as how it really is. Okay? It's not how it really is. This is how the Vedana is landing according to the condition of the mind, the mood that we're in. Right? The Vedana also is an appearance that arises dependent on the quality of the heart and mind. Yeah. You see these keys that just keep fitting the locks, right? If I'm not explaining it perfectly, it doesn't mean that these locks are not really, really being perfectly fitted by these keys. Yeah, say the Buddha was actually one of the great lock pickers the world has ever produced. Yeah, he could undo these incredibly intricate locks. And he was also a fine locksmith. He could actually make really beautiful teachings, give us these keys to apply. So there's this subtle, very subtle arising of this subliminal, that means it's beneath the boundary of consciousness. Vedana exists beneath the boundary of consciousness. Picking and choosing, picking and choosing. And we'll see that picking and choosing starts to take us away from our centeredness. Yeah? Lead to wanting to get this, wanting to get rid of that. These appearances in the heart and mind, they arise with a sense of demand on them. Yeah? You notice that? It's an appearance arises with this sense of demand, this sense of pushing and pull. Right? But it doesn't have to be this way. There's possibilities. Right? The key into this experience. Possibilities for appearances with less and less demand, more and more peace. And so we'll come back, we'll go into this a little bit more, we'll make it more practical, but I just want to point out that I don't feel I would ever have noticed that there was a Vedana on experience happening. Yeah, this is really a case where the insight is inherited from the teachings and then I apply it to my experience. Yeah, so it says in places in the suttas, you know, come and lend an ear. Come and lend your ear to this. Give this a listen. Yeah, but not just listen, then go try it and see. Test it for yourself. Yeah. You said before, don't just read the recipe, right? Reading recipes is not so hard. Yeah. You could keep reading the recipes, but then get into the kitchen and see what you can do with it. Or if we've been doing our samadhi surfing, yeah? Get in the ocean. See what waves you can ride with this understanding. And the interesting thing is, as we explore this, we actually see more and more insights coming together. Ah, this is a really swift categorization. It's very, very fast. But the insights that we can get about that is, it's actually not about the object. It actually says more about me right now. Yeah, it actually says a lot more about the shape of this heart and mind that I'm finding this person really annoying. Yeah. It's like, oh, they're really unpleasant. It's like, and that might say a lot more about what's going on in here. And you see, the preference, it arises. It's not who I am. It's not self. My preferences are not who I am. Right? They're arising and they're known. It can't be who I am. But they're all about me. They're all about the self. They're all about what the self wants to get. Yeah, but they're also not self. Very strange, very strange. We also get to see it's not fixed. It changes over time, you know, according to the environment, according to the mood, according to the sense of space and time, even. Yeah. So even space and time is not fixed. And it not being fixed, it changes our perception of the space and time that's existing. Oh, I haven't got much space, I haven't got much time. Certain Vedanas are more likely to arise. Oh, there's loads of space, loads of time. Certain Vedanas are likely to arise. Independent of what the object is. Strange. The Vedana itself can be changed. It can be intentionally changed. Yeah, we can lead from pleasure to pain, from pain to pleasure. We can actually incline along this spectrum. I'm going to explain all of this stuff. I'm not just talking voodoo stuff. Yeah, it's very practical. This is how we'll do it. Yeah. But any experience, there's just sensations and there's Vedana. No experience can arise without a Vedana. We're not trying to get rid of Vedana unless we're also trying to get rid of experiences, which at this point I don't think is high on our priorities. There's contact and there's Vedana, right? I don't know if anyone's having an experience where there's contact and I notice now the Vedana's on there, right? It's subliminal, it's beneath the boundary of consciousness for most of us, yeah? No contact, then no Vedana for a conscious being, right? You just notice there's this arises, it's somewhat pleasant, somewhat unpleasant, somewhat neither nor for us in that moment. Let's just take one of those for now, right? The Vedana does not belong to the contact. It can easily change. It can easily change. So if we're feeling about something and we're reacting about something and we're getting really serious about it and we're really like, no, it's unpleasant. How could anyone be with it? It's unpleasant. Just know it can change. In fact, it's far more likely to change than it is likely to remain the same. Yeah? Something's going to change in all of the factors unless you don't give it any attention at all, right? Which is what we typically do. It's like, oh no, I've defined it, I'm clear about it, it's unpleasant, and I want nothing to do with it. I'm just going to work out how to get it out of my house as soon as possible. But like, if you actually pay attention to something, you'll notice, oh, the Vedana's already changing. already nowhere near as unpleasant as it was before. Or it's, oh, it's getting worse because, I'm relating to it this way or that way. Yeah. So as long as you don't give it kind attention, maybe in your imagination it cannot change. But in the reality of paying attention to changing phenomena, it's changing. If we take a silly example, like, say you're a really big fan of cheesecake, well, vegan cheesecake, yeah, and you think, oh, it's delicious, I love cheesecakes, it's the best. You keep eating it, you'll soon become bored. You ever notice how you actually miss most of the meals you eat? Yeah, kind of like boredom just kicks in. First mouthful, oh, it's really delicious, this is the best thing I've ever had. It's like, and then the next mouthful, I'm thinking, oh, I must tell that friend about this, and I'm not tasting anything, I'm just off in that kind of thought, right? So when we eat a meal, it's just slow down, really slow down, just to be aware, the thinking's going to go fast. If you're really enjoying it, you have to slow down, otherwise, it's almost impossible to taste food. So very quickly it goes from delicious to boring, right? It's gone from pleasant to unpleasant, it's gone to kind of neutral, and it'll eventually go to unpleasant or even disgusting, all that grease and sugar of a vegan cheesecake clogging up the system of the heart and mind. So, oh God, why would you even do that? And then, someone, do you want to finish it off? It's like, no, I hope I never see it again. And it went from, delicious to there in a very small amount of time. It's going to change. The Vedana isn't fixed, right? So it's just keeping that in mind. Maybe something kind of on the sidebar, we can just take a light point, so extra relaxation moment. There's something that's quite interesting to notice is that our mind fabricates an estimation of what something will be like. Yeah, the mind actually fabricates an estimation of what something will be like. So an example for me is this morning, I think I was doing some yoga. Yeah, and really recommend doing some yoga. Really look after your bodies on these retreats. Yeah, it's like got it on the schedule there, and I really think you should do it as much as you can. It's really nice to do those. But we can often have this, like, oh, I don't want to do my yoga. It's kind of unpleasant. It's got this, oh, it's all these, stretching, oh, it hurts a bit and that. And so it kind of, in my mind, I notice it has an unpleasant Vedana in the mind. But when we do it, it's actually packed with enjoyable experiences. Those stretches that align the body and that kind of opens up certain areas. And then afterwards, that feeling is, ah, oh, I did my yoga. Everything's alive and kind of zinging in the body. And if there's not, some major injury, then it's just lovely. Such a lovely thing to do. And yet, I'm one of the people in life who just doesn't do it enough. Don't do it regularly enough. Like, oh, I'm too busy for my yoga or whatever. You're probably not like that. So you're probably doing it all the time. But just to say, so it's like the mind imagines a Vedana on the experience, but the actual experience isn't like that. Isn't like that. We've been doing a few, Sangha Seva runs these retreats recently. We did one called Sacred Places, making places sacred again, making them beautiful, making them fulfilling for nature. And so we went out litter picking, like picking up other people's rubbish. Like, definitely an unpleasant Vedana, going to pick up someone else's rubbish. That's disgusting. But I loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was so enjoyable to pick up litter from the sand dunes. Yeah. So enjoyable to do that. And it just turns out, I had no idea. I had no idea that I loved picking up litter. I had no idea it was so enjoyable. Honestly, I can't wait to get out and do it again. It's so good. So good. The same thing happens when we do the Being Peace retreat in Palestine. Every year I say, oh, it's going to be a hassle picking olives, listening to people's stories about what a difficult, painful life they're having under occupation. We're actually going out there, coming closer to places of conflict and pain, coming with the ability to listen, to bring our meditation practice into those areas. Really enjoyable. So deeply pleasant. So enjoyable. I just can't wait to do it again. Really can't wait. When I remember what it's really like. Yeah. So there's actually so much joy, so much possibility opens out for us when we don't believe the Vedana assumption on the future. Just don't believe it. The Vedana arises, just don't believe it. You just got to think, oh, maybe that's not right. Go and try it. Go and try it. The other thing is, when we have a positive experience, we have to linger in the goodness. You have to linger in the goodness. It's like to re-encode the memory. Right? And this is an example of where samadhi training is really, really helpful. What Zaha was guiding us to do today, like lingering in the good, which begins with actually just lingering in the non-unpleasant. Yeah, this whole Vedana categorization, it's not unpleasant. It can be neutral, yeah, it can be really fantastic. But if we can just incline the mind to linger there, in okayness, something that's okay, right? Can we just linger in that? And that, particularly in relationship to projection on the future, I need to remember, I need to embed in my memory, yoga is good, it's good. I want to walk past my yoga mat and I want it to catch my, oh, who's that? Yoga mat, yes. I want to get on that yoga mat and just get that good feeling again, yeah? Dive in there, get it. You know, I want to walk past a piece of litter and instead of thinking, what idiot threw that down? I'll think, oh, I could pick that up. That'll feel really good, you know, get into that. So against all the odds, we're learning to sustain our attention on what is going well. Yeah, it's not against the odds, meaning we didn't evolve to do this, yeah? We evolved to see problems and to react to pain and to, you know, really unpleasantness, let me have some. Yeah, it's like attention wants to go there. It's neither this gross push or pull on life. This really subtle mode, yeah, it's not demanding, but it's also not tuning out at times, yeah. Can we support the lovely without grasping on it as well? Right, this whole side. It's going to take practice, sure, but actually you already have the way. You already know how to do this. Now, anyone who's ever watched a sunset, who's ever just sat by the ocean, watching the waves, yeah, deeply touched by those experiences, but we're not grasping. Yeah. I don't know. It doesn't happen for me, so I'm guessing it probably doesn't happen for other people because I'm a pretty greedy person. But like when the sun sets, I don't think, oh, pity that's over. You know, I want more of that. Yeah. If only there was a rewind and we could get the sunset again. It's like, no, we enjoyed it. We nourished our attention in it. And then it's gone. Yeah. And we can practice that again, like just giving away what's beautiful to us. Yeah, like we did in the metta practice. You know, that delightful friendliness we can give away. Okay, so I want to get on to some of the practices, but let's just quickly review the sense of the Vedana. Is it's an added on feature onto the experience, yeah. But actually, Vedana is like the currents in an ocean, right? There's always a current in the ocean. There's never no movement. So the nature of ocean is to be currented, yeah, it's to move in currents. Vedana practice is noticing the current. So we could just say, we're in the ocean of life, what's the current of this moment? Is there a push, is there a pull towards the unpleasant, towards the pleasant? Now can we not add to the current? Can we just relax and observe, ah, oh, there's a current here, right? And of course, currents, they can build up. So when we tune into it, it might already be quite an escalated current. Yeah. Do you know this word riptide? I don't know what you might call that in Hebrew. The tide that kind of can pull you out, you know, and really kind of a bit scary. Yeah. It's like a confluence of strong pushes and pulls, pulling away. Or whirlpools in currents. Yeah, you get that spiraling around, pushing and pulls, really. Usually it comes when there's aversion to an aversion to aversion to aversion. And each time we push the aversion, it actually creates, and you know, it's, oh, it's really horrible pushing this aversion away. And it's like, and so you push that away and it's, you know, it takes you into this whirlpool. But when we get tugged into that, actually the right advice is not to struggle so much. Right? Not to demand something on top of that. You know, not to demand there are no whirlpools, demand there are no riptides. So there's some of the dangers. Here's some of the practices, right? So when something's seen as pleasant, can we see I don't need to pull it towards me to enjoy it? Yeah, I can appreciate it from here, like the sunset, relaxed and attentive. If something's unpleasant, I don't need to push it away. I don't need to push it away. That's going to make it more unpleasant. Maybe I can just allow it. Maybe I can just allow it. Very simple, just very immediate. Don't need to pull it towards me. I don't need to push it away. I have possibilities, I have options. Or we could even see this is added on. This is added on. This isn't the nature of this thing, to be pleasant, to be unpleasant. It's not inherently this way. I could see it the other way. Could see it the other way. And we might even want to make this kind of active. Invite our perception to reveal it another way. So how could we do that? We could take another element of this experience. Yeah? So we can actually find a pleasure in something unpleasant, or if it's really kind of delightful, we could actually draw some attention to the drawback in the delight. Yeah? There's always more dimensions to things. So we can skillfully tune into that, and that might just lessen the push and the pull. You know, kind of, I noticed the other day, I was, where was I? Maybe I was here. And I needed to pee. And I really needed to, it was like, oh no, I really got to go, you know, I'm really busting to pee. Or there could be another time, you know, I'm in an environment, there's a really bad smell, you know, it's like you go into the toilet after someone's just used, oh, it's got a bad smell in here, you know, and you just notice, unpleasant, an aversion, you know, but I have to go, so I'm in the toilet, you know. But there's actually sensations to be delighted in here, you know. And that just brings more space, more freedom, right here in the midst. It's like, oh, make space. Make space when there's this shutting down. It's, oh, I can actually enjoy here. There's an equanimity there available, yeah, to be equipoised, to be there in the midst of it. It's really blissful. Yeah, and in meditation, we sometimes get into pain in the body, body posture, all of that. Don't make your posture extra painful. Right? Life's painful enough. Don't put yourself in uncomfortable positions. I said in the group today, your body doesn't belong to you, it belongs to nature. Yeah. And nature wants it back soon, so please don't break it. You know, treat it very kindly. So don't treat it badly on this retreat. Look after it. Yeah. So we've got to be intelligent. Maybe sit on a chair, relax with it all as much as you can, being soft. Now, if we were more on the kind of the greedy side of things, you know, so we have this kind of aversive side, you know, pushing away, the greedy side, pulling it towards. We might want to think, you know. When we're eating something nice, I want more of this. Get more on my plate. You know, oh, I'm going to have some more of this. Yet we actually have enough here to enjoy. Yes, that sense of slowing down. The pleasant is already here. But maybe we also want to play with the conception that is in our perception, right? The conception that's in our perception. How I'm thinking about this thing, right? The taste buds, for example, might be having a great time. Yeah. And that's it. They're saying more. I want more of this. This is pleasant. Give me more. But, you know, maybe already the belly is saying, we've had enough and we'd like you to stop. You know, so we tune into that, like those more dimensions. Like, actually, yeah, belly said enough, taste buds, I'm afraid. You know, so I think belly doesn't often get heard so well here, and we're going to stop. We're going to stop. You know, and this is maybe taking a bit far, but you might also just want to understand in that, back to this kind of idea, the conception that is our perception. When we imagine having more of it, we're actually imagining in our mouth right now is like a slice of pie. Yeah, it's that slice of the pie, and it's, oh, really nice. But actually, in your mouth now is this disgusting looking mush, right? And if you were to spit that out on your plate, you might really hesitate before like sticking the fork back in it and putting it back in your mouth. But you're there saying, it's so good. It's actually really disgusting looking thing. So we're just really enjoying it. So, you know, there are just like different ways of playing with our experience. And I'm really happy for you to enjoy the food that you eat. But if you, it's just a way of explaining these examples. There are different ways of looking at experiences. Yeah. So if you're kind of craving things, you're having all these kinds of fantasies, in any way, they can come up on retreat. Yeah. I'm not going to feed you any extra fantasies. But like, really just look at it. It's actually, is it that delightful? Is it a completely brilliant thing? Yeah. And it might just ease the craving for more. And rather than going into disgust, we're just doing that just to slow down. Maybe we'll savor it. Maybe we can enjoy it. You know, rather than just like shoveling in more and more. Right? And we move from greed to something much more balanced. And in that, something of a samadhi comes. Yeah? That samadhi is that feeling of freedom. So for many of us, being disciplined, in a sense, is actually more deeply nourishing than getting what we desire or getting rid of what we imagine we can't stand to be around. Yeah. Expanding that boundary. Yeah. It's expandable. There's always these possibilities. So what we're kind of talking about today is these immediate responses that come through our evolutionary developed patterning. Yeah. This Vedana rises, creates a preference, creates an urge for demand, and that demand creates this dukkha feeling in the body, heart and mind. Yeah. And so this insight that there is a Vedana here, just coming back to that simple noticing, opens out so many practices, so many kinds of well-being. Yeah, and that really limits the next time these impacts of what are called these hindrances arise in our practice. Yeah. This pushing and pulling are the first of the hindrances. These imbalances of energy, too much agitation, too much dullness, they're unpleasant. A feeling of confusion or doubt, it's unpleasant. And really there's only one hindrance, demanding. Demanding for things to be other than they are, and not understanding that there are these possibilities to play, to shape, bring space. And so those are some of the things we can open out tomorrow in the practice. And seeing that dukkha dependently originates on demands. And seeing that there are possibilities for our practice. So thank you for listening and sharing this space together. Let's just have a quiet minute together to close this session. So thank you again for your listening and your presence with this, and really deep gratitude to Sagiv for writing up the notes in the chat, and those will be saved, I think, yeah, and available for us. So really great service that you've offered there. Undeniably pleasant. So thank you again, everyone, and we'll take a half hour period for some walking practice, and I really hope you enjoy that, and then we'll come back for the last sitting of the day.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.